Well, just like people, our pets are healthy most of the time if we're lucky, but when they're sick or they get injured, you want them to have the best and most effective care possible. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Once a month, we have the chance and privilege to visit with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She does a great job of staying on top of new developments, sharing them with us in ways that we can easily use them. Dr. Sandy, always great to have you.
It is nice to be here.
We have lots of things we can talk about. My cat, Coco, is going to be operated on pretty quickly here, and we can talk about that later. But I want to get into spring weather because that means fleas and ticks.
You got it. You know, once we start getting weather that is consistently above 35 degrees, above freezing, ticks love this kind of weather, especially deer ticks. And the big thing that I'm seeing is a lot of people tend to link giving heartworm preventative with flea and tick preventative. And really, we've got ticks almost year round, except this winter. We had a really cold winter. But yeah. I like to tell people that for tick control, you don't need 365 days of tick control, but you do need 12 months, if you catch my drift, because there usually isn't a month that goes by where we don't have ticks out there. So I thought I would maybe throughout the show throw in a few little trivia questions regarding fleas and ticks, because there's a lot of misconceptions out there.
Oh, well, give me one.
Okay. Ticks drop from trees. True or false?
I think I remember you talking about this before, and I don't think that's true.
That's correct. That is false. Ticks will only climb up about 18 inches high off the ground, and so they like to be in kind of low, brushy areas, which is probably why we see a lot of them on our dogs, especially around their face in that area, because as they go through, the ticks are holding on with their back legs and have their front legs out kind of waving in the air. It's called questing, and as soon as something brushes by them, they glob on and immediately start feeding. They're not like fleas that start running around. And so when we find ticks in our hair or on our neck, it's because they've actually had the opportunity to crawl up our clothing, and that is the first place that they found that they could get a blood meal. So, so keep your pants tucked in, collars up tight, you know, and do a check if you've been out in the woods with your pets.
Yeah, and check those pets for sure. Turkey hunting season is upon us now, so there'll be lots of people.
Yeah, and we even know that turkeys are one of the animals that carry the deer tick. And people don't think about the wild turkey as a possibility. But boy, I had a wild turkey. I live in, Janesville, just, you know, in the city of Janesville. And we had a turkey in our backyard, our neighbor's backyard, you know, little fenced in backyards. And there's a hen running back and forth. We've got it on, you know, pictures of it. And all I'm thinking of is, I'm just as bad as my clients. I have not put my dogs on flea and tick preventative. So that night I went home and made sure everybody got treated.
Oh, man. So 12 months a year.
12 months a year.
All right. All right. Well, we'll talk some more about that as we go along. Bev and Lena has got a question for you, though. Bev, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. And thanks for taking my call. I am calling because we have three dogs, males, and the little one has, as wonderful as they are now, we're presented with a little problem. The youngest one is lifting his leg periodically in the house.
Okay. Now,
and I want to know what we can do about this.
Now, are the three of them neutered?
Yes,
they are neutered. Okay. You know, when we see a dog that leg lifts, neutering is always one of the first things we recommend. And that's going to stop probably about half of the urine marking, because we know that some of it is to kind of leave their calling card looking for girlfriends when they're out for a walk. And the other reason why dogs will urinate is to mark their territory. And especially indoor dogs, if there is some social grief between the dogs where maybe the little one is feeling a little insecure with the rest of the dogs in the household, it's not uncommon for them to use urine marking as a way of making everything smell like them in the house. So things that you can do. This is a really difficult problem to get under control. I mean, you can work with an applied animal behaviorist to actually get to the bottom of what may be the social stress between the three dogs. Often we never even see anything that would be the things that we would think would trigger it. What I've done in many of these cases, too, is just kind of deal with it by not actually solving the problem, but preventing the dog from being able to eliminate on the furniture. And it means using something called a belly band. If you just go online and you know, type in belly bands for dogs, you're going to find lots of people that make them, sell them. You can even make your own. And they're just a kind of like a cummerbund that goes around his parts down below and collects the urine, so it's still going to lift his leg, but it will prevent your house from being soiled. Really important that you also clean those spots where he's urinated with an appropriate enzymatic cleaner. And unfortunately, when we see dogs urinating, it's often on things like the fabric of our couches and things. And so that can be a real problem to get under control. A couple of my favorite urine cleaning products are Urine Off and another one called AIP. And it actually comes with a big syringe that you can inject into some of the padding and so on if it is in your furniture. So I'm sorry I don't have a cure for your dog, but you know, just understand that he's feeling insecure. Anything we can do to make him feel a little more secure in the environment, whether it's individual attention, giving him a job to do, like, you know, sitting and waiting, having all the dogs do that kind of thing so none of them are the top dog, that may actually help a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I remember Patricia McConnell talking about making sure that you're the leader and there's no...
That's what I was getting. Yeah. Just making sure that the dog kind of knows who's the boss, but it's all done with love, though. Yep.
Yes, it is. Mark in New London, it's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi. See, we just adopted an 8-year-old Australian Shepherd and took her in to have her checked over by our vet and wanted to know... Andy's opinion on some of the new medications that you can give the dogs to help prevent Lyme disease and repel the ticks, the new chewables versus the topical.
Yeah, there's a new product out that Mariel has come out with. It's called NexGard, and the active ingredient is a floxalaner. I don't know why I can remember that, but it's kind of a funny name. It's a beefy cube that is labeled for flea and tick control that you use monthly. Looking at the data, it works very well on fleas. On ticks, it's a little above 80% effective. I think it's like 83, 85, something like that. I'm sorry, I don't know the exact number. The downside is it's only labeled for one species of tick and not the deer tick. And so we don't have any research to show that it is effective against the deer tick. I have to assume that it is just because, you know, most products are going to not differentiate between different species of ticks, but just know that that's not on the label. It does take about 48 hours for ticks to die with this particular medication as well. And as a result, if you are having your dog in a heavy tick area, especially with the little tiny deer ticks where they may burrow into that, you know, hair and start feeding, it's very easy to miss them. And within 48 hours, you can have disease transmission. So I think it's an appropriate product for a dog that is at low risk. In fact, I gave it to my dogs this month. That's what I ended up giving because I have two bulldogs that, you know, rarely ever leave our backyard. And yes, I did have a turkey on the other side of the fence. But, you know, again, their exposure to heavy tick areas is really limited. So I feel that it's appropriate for mine. It may not be appropriate for your dog.
Hmm. Yeah, we're in a fairly heavy tick area. In fact, our previous dog did come down with Lyme disease because of the that we have in the area.
Yeah,
I read online last night that supposedly it's supposed to work for deer ticks. It's just that they weren't done with the testing.
Yeah, the regulatory agency did not accept their research on it, is what I've been told. So I'm still waiting to hear if they're going to get that label put on there or not. But, you know, there are other safe and effective things that you can use. One of my favorites is something called the Seresto collar that is made by the Bayer Company. Very safe, especially even if you've got a dog that's swimming. It doesn't leach out into the water, so there's very limited environmental impact. It lasts for 8 months if your dog isn't swimming, about 5 months if they are swimming. The other products that I like are things like the Frontline Plus, and in some parts of the country, Frontline has come out with a kind of another new improved version called Frontline Tri-Tac. They've added in another chemical to improve the tick efficacy because, again, just because of tick biology, they don't run through the hair coat and pick up a lot of the chemical that's going to kill them. And so if they happen to start feeding in an area with limited hair contact, they may not get enough of the chemical fast enough to die faster. So by adding in this other chemical, it does improve the tick killing efficacy a little bit faster. I don't know if it's available in Wisconsin yet. There are certain states where it's not available, but it should be soon.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Mark. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. What's going on with your dog or cat? Taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. We have Mary in Oshkosh up next. Mary, hi.
Hello. Dr. Sandy, I recently, about a month ago, adopted two new cats.
Mm-hmm.
They're 2 years old. And one of them developed some kitty acne under her chin.
Mm-hmm.
And it got scabby, little bit of blood, and I treated it with some clean cloths and kind of washing it with some calendula lotion, and it did go away. But I suspect that she's susceptible to kitty acne, and I'm wondering if you have any recommendations for continued treatment. What should I be doing to try to avoid this kind of thing?
Right. And many cats that do get acne will often get sometimes just simple little blackheads, which usually don't amount to anything, but it can progress to full-blown cystic acne that can be quite painful and irritating for them. Definitely keeping it clean. Often we have to treat these patients with systemic antibiotics, or if we've got a fungal infection, antifungals. And so I think just keeping up with your hygiene like you're doing right now is going to be helpful. One of the other things that's been suggested, and I don't know how much of this is like an old wives' tale or whatever, but as veterinarians, we always recommend it, is to switch from plastic bowls to either metal or ceramic, because they feel that the plastic may harbor some of the oils and things that can go rancid, and the chin's coming in contact with this, and so you get more irritation. So that is one of the thoughts, washing food bowls out after every meal, so that, again, you don't have those rancid fats there. Whether that's going to help or not and prevent recurrences, I don't know. But I think you're on the right path if you've got it cleaned up with your home care.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you, Mary, for calling. Appreciate it. We are going to turn to Mark in Green Bay next. Mark, hello.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question about a yellow lab. I have a 10-year-old yellow lab, and she recently, over the last probably 6 months or so, maybe a little bit longer, 8 months, has periodically been vomiting in the house. And it's not on a regular basis. It'll be maybe once or twice a week, and then we'll go a month or two, and then nothing. But then it'll be again. And we're curious as to maybe it's something she's out eating in the woods behind the house, or...
So what is she vomiting? Is it food or phlegm? Anything in particular?
You know, it's very liquid. Every once in a while, we'll see a piece of food or two in it, but for the most part, it's really dark brown and,
liquid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, this would be something that I would be concerned about. Anytime we see a change in the dog's habits, behavior like this, I start worrying, especially in an older dog, that there may be some other underlying medical problem. And even though it is intermittent and she may appear healthy and happy between episodes, still going in, getting a good geriatric workup done, which will include probably getting some blood work, because we do see animals that have kidney disease, liver disease, and pancreatic disease and so on, you know, having intermittent vomiting. And so getting some blood work done is going to be helpful. If that all comes back normal, then you may want to be looking at, should we get some imaging done, whether that be abdominal x-rays, an ultrasound to look at the GI tract, something to try to figure out, you know, why this vomiting may be occurring. I'd also, while you're getting all that stuff worked on, start keeping, I know it sounds strange, but a vomit diary. So, like, when you fed the dog, when the vomiting occurs, what was in the vomitus, and, you know, just to try to get a better handle, because often, especially in households with more than one person, somebody else may be cleaning it up, and it may actually be occurring at a higher frequency than what you're thinking. So keep that and take that information into your veterinarian, and hopefully they can get to the bottom of it.
Good enough. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Vet Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Cynthia Schuster, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Larry Mueller here. So great to have you along today. Join us at 800-642-1234 with your questions, or you can go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, post questions there. And if you've got a great photo of your pet, we always love to see those photos as well. We have Megan, who wrote to us on Facebook, as a matter of fact, wondering, Sandy, if you could comment on the link of grains in food to ear infection in dogs. We have a lab mix who has continual ear problems and have heard a grain-free diet could help.
Well, I think we've got kind of partially correct here, in that many times when we see chronic ear infections in dogs, it either has something to do with the dog's individual kind of microenvironment in the ear, like if you took a poodle and had lots of hair in the ears, or a basset hound with real droopy ears, or like in the case of a lab, which are the kind of the poster child for allergies, sometimes long-term chronic allergies are one of the leading causes of chronic ear infections in dogs. And it's because when we have a pet with allergies, the skin, particularly in the ears, sometimes ears and feet, becomes inflamed. It becomes warmer, moister, and allows the bacteria and yeast that are there to just start multiplying because they enjoy that change in the environment. The one of the things that kind of irks me a little bit is that there's this, you know, there's so many diets on the market now that are, you know, touting to, you know, be, you know, the cure-all for all these skin problems and everything we may be dealing with. Unfortunately, grains as an ingredient are way down low on the list of allergens in for dogs. Typically, it's going to be the protein source, such as poultry, dairy, beef and so on, those are going to be your top allergens. If you want to see if your dog has a food allergy and see if this will help prevent these ear infections from coming back, you really need to do a food trial. And that involves using a hydrolyzed protein diet, very strict. You can't even use beef-flavored chewable heartworm pills or anything like that. So for at least a couple of months where they get that and only that. I know that if you go to the pet stores, you're going to see diets that say limited antigen, which is usually they'll say it's like a duck and or a venison-based diet. When those diets have been studied, they found that even though they say that it's made out of venison and there's no chicken anywhere on the label, you start looking, you're going to find other sources of protein in it. And it's because it's been made in a plant that has manufactured other foods, so you get some cross-contamination. Kind of think like peanuts for people. You see packages that say this food has been manufactured in a facility that's handled peanuts. You don't want to eat that if you have a severe peanut allergy. So that's the problem with the over-the-counter diets, is that they can be contaminated and you don't get a really good feeding trial. The whole reason why these grain-free diets have hit the scene goes back to the problem with wheat gluten meal that was contaminated with melamine about 5 or 6 years ago. And the whole pet feeding community went, well, if wheat gluten meal is bad, then wheat must be bad. If wheat's bad, then all grains are bad. So let's go to a grain-free diet. And in reality, you're paying a lot for a diet that nutritionally probably isn't more sound than some of the other standard diets that are out there.
We have a number of great photos. And here's one that relates to something you and I were going to talk about, which is weight. We got a Brianna sent a photo of her cat Milo, is 13, weighs somewhere around 14 pounds. And is there one cat food in stores that may be better than others for weight management?
Well, that is a really good way to kind of segue into kind of some of my tips for weight loss in cats. And I think, you know, when there isn't a particular diet that is going to be effective, and some cats may do better. I mean, we're primarily looking at the calorie content of the food and knowing the calorie content. Some of the, like, grain-free diets that cats are being switched to are actually quite high in fats. And so even though they're a higher protein, lower carb diet, which makes sense for a cat, they may still be too high. So knowing the calorie content of the food that you're feeding, have your veterinarian do a caloric determination to find out what your cat's ideal weight should be, how many calories your cat should eat for that to support that ideal weight. One of the things that's come out recently, and it really makes sense, is looking at cats that and how they're fed. And what they found that is smaller, more frequent meals. So you're still feeding the same number of calories per day, but instead of feeding a cat once or twice a day, smaller, more frequent meals made the cat be more active, and they actually lost weight faster. And I think it's because they start anticipating that they're going to get to eat if they're fed multiple times. And that's where these automatic feeders really work well. Now, the problem is if you have multiple cats, how are you going to control which cat gets the food? And then you've got to get into using the cat doors that are, you know, linked to the cat's microchip or a little magnet so that they're all separated. And so it can become a huge issue. Or you just have to be there and put the food down, kind of like what I have to do with my dogs. I have to put the food down and stand guard because my new dog is very good at in a second, just going over and consuming anything that Van has left. So we have to watch really carefully. The other tip is to start early. And I think one of the things that we as veterinarians have kind of fallen down on is when we have an animal spayed or neutered, we can change the pet's metabolism by up to 30%, making it a lower metabolism. And I think weight loss has to start right at the time of spaying and neutering when they're young. There's a new diet out by Royal Canin that's called a spay-neuter formula, and they make it for kittens, adults, seniors, and so on. And it may be something that people would want to look into or talk to your veterinarian about, but I think it's important to really start watching calories because once they gain that weight, it's very difficult to get it off. So, and I think, too, a lot of us tend to be keep our head in the sand regarding how big our cat actually is. When you ask an owner what they think of their cat's body condition, the majority of owners think it's normal. But when a veterinarian looks at it, we can say, no, they're overweight. And so, you know, not paying attention to what you think, but actually take the advice from your veterinarian. So, and you have to be creative with exercise. In the picture that was put up on Facebook, they have the cat out on a roof, looks like enjoying some of the sunshine in a nice, safe cat environment. Boy, that would be wonderful to be able to have a cat out there so he can wander around and get a little more exercise than laying on the couch.
Oh, absolutely. And many more photos as well. We'll get to some of them. Lots of dog photos today, too. There's some really cute dogs. So we'll reference those as time goes on here. But I want to give Kelly in Milwaukee a chance to join in. Kelly, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi. I have two Huskies, two Siberians. And the female has glaucoma, and in February had her right eye removed. And she's on two different drops to keep the left eye healthy, and so that one doesn't go. But as I understand it, I have been told that in over 80% of the cases, the good eye will follow the bad.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if there's anything else I can do. I do know that the makeup of the drainage holes in her eyes is equally bad in the surviving eye as it is in... But I'm very concerned about how much longer we can keep that eye going.
Yeah.
She's on Timolol, two drops, one in the morning, one at night.
Mm-hmm.
She has a Neopolydex with a steroid that she has twice a week,
okay,
a drop in that eye. And I've been kind of like self-educating myself with some acupressure around the eye simply because it makes me feel as if I'm doing
something
more. You know, and the doctor said, well, it certainly couldn't hurt her. So.
Yeah, you just don't want to put pressure on the eye itself. As a former Basset Hound owner, there's certain breeds of dogs that are more prone to developing glaucoma. And I think it's a matter of going in for frequent rechecks, making sure that the pressures are staying low. Often dogs have to be on more than one medication that you may find that just the Timolol by itself is not going to be enough, and they may have to be on a second one on top of it on a daily basis. And, you know, just know that we do see, I mean, even if she does lose that eye, dogs don't have the same kind of grief over their loss of vision. I'm saying that broadly, but some dogs do become quite distressed. But the majority of them adjust very well because they tend to lose their vision in a slow, gradual process, and they get used to it. And so it's a matter of making sure that you start teaching her maybe sounds for, recalls, whistles or her name or clapping your hands or whatever, changing your behavior that you're not going to startle her once her vision has decreased. But it's, that's really all you can do is just, work with that ophthalmologist, lots of checking to make sure that pressure is staying all right, adding in more medication as needed, and keeping your fingers crossed that she's going to be in that 20% that maintains her vision the rest of her life.
Yep.
All right.
Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it very much. And probably don't move the furniture around a lot.
Yeah, that's the other thing. It's just keeping the environment pretty stable. Make sure your yard's fenced in and so on. Yep.
Sue in La Crosse, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a new puppy. He's 13 weeks old, Springer.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a habit of when he's resting or if he's just very comfortable and not even asleep, and if you try to move him or pet him, he'll growl at you. And we're just wondering if this is something we should do something about now. We've been trying to use positive discipline with him, with treats and things. So what would you suggest to do about
that? Yeah, definitely. I mean, I always worry a growl is like one step away from something more serious happening. And he's giving you a warning for a reason. And whether it's that he's grumpy because he hurts, he's grumpy because he's been startled, he's grumpy because he's anxious. There's a whole host of reasons. And so if he checks out fine physically, that there's nothing physically wrong with him, this would be something that I would be addressing with an applied animal behaviorist. Although training is going to be helpful to have a dog that sits and stays and so on, it really comes down to often identifying, what is triggering your dog to growl. And I think the mistake many people make is they assume that the dog is trying to control them. And in reality, it may be that the dog is more timid or anxious and has learned that I growl, the boogeyman leaves me alone. That would be what I would be looking into. No punishment if you can. If you can identify times where this happens, then I like to think about like jolling the dog up. So if you know that the dog is on the sofa or, resting on its dog bed and you need to get the dog's attention, do it from a distance, and when the dog is now, up and wagging its tail and coming over to see you, that's the time to greet them. And instead of, when they're laying down there. So working on trying to kind of change their state of mind by getting them into a better mood, like, saying, "Whoa, you grumpy dog, let's get out and go for a walk," And so now you've got a dog that's wagging its tail and happier. But I really think that this is the earlier you get this under control, the better, because I can see a bite happening pretty soon.
Yeah.
That's what we're worried about. I know he's been to the vet twice since we got him, and he's fine that way. And, if we redirect you know, redirect him first before, like you said, we go over by him so he's not startled or anything. That might help.
Yeah.
And lacrosse, what kind of experts would there be in lacrosse area if we don't see an improvement?
Yeah, I don't know. This would be something that you can contact. There's a professional association of veterinary animal behaviorists that is called AVSAB, American Veterinary Society for Animal Behavior. That would be a good website to go to. They do have listings of people that are either board certified in behavior or have a strong interest in behavior. And it may mean that you may have to travel somewhere to be able to find someone that is qualified to be able to work with your puppy.
Yeah. If there's certified applied animal behaviorist.
Yep.
You
don't want to just go with a dog trainer. You want somebody that's got some specialty education in dealing with serious problems like this.
Yeah. Good luck, Sue. Thank you very much for calling. And Rich in Green Bay, hello to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Happy belated spring here, but yeah. I'm calling about my 8.5-year-old. Or 10-year-old, 8.5-pound Shih Tzu.
Mm-hmm.
Last summer, she had what I described as a seizure. She had never had one before, and subsequently she went to the vet and was hydrated all day and medicated. And then we subsequently took her down to the Madison Clinic, UW Clinic, and consistently was diagnosed with an undefined neurological event.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, she's been perfectly fine. Her neuro exam down there, as far as reflexes, was fine about 3 or 4 weeks after it occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she has a tendency to build up tartar in her mouth, and the teeth are getting like stage 4 tartar.
Okay.
And the vet has recommended doing a teeth cleaning, and I said, well, I would much rather wait at least maybe a year or something like that before I put her under a general anesthesia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in humans, anesthesia is probably one of the higher risks of an operation. And I wanted to get your opinion on taking that stance.
Yeah, you know, just having like serious dental problems is also going to pose some major health risks for your dog regarding the heart, the kidneys, and so on. It's a source of infection. It's discomfort. And if your veterinarian is recommending it, it would be something I would really take seriously. When you start looking at the statistics regarding anesthetic complications or anesthetic deaths in animals that are perfectly healthy, we see about 1 in 2,000 animals run into issues with anesthetic deaths. When it's a patient like your dog who has this unexplained neurologic deficit or defect that is resulted in a seizure, it may increase it to about 1 in 500. So it's still... it's there, but it's still pretty low odds of something serious happening. If you are afraid to have this done in a situation where, you know, are they going to be monitored enough? Is there, going through recovery correctly? The right drugs being used? It may be worthwhile to even consider consulting with a veterinary anesthesiologist. You've been to the veterinary school. We do have anesthesia folks on staff that are boarded in anesthesia. They specialize. That's all they do. And they're very willing to work with clients to kind of take away some of your fears about having one of these procedures done. I think the big thing is making sure that you're using correct drugs that are not going to be affecting her brain adversely. There are some drugs that are a little more, they can cause seizures, and so we'd want to avoid some of those. Watching her blood pressure, watching her temperature, making sure that she's on a good plane of anesthesia to keep her oxygen levels up. And so it does take a lot of equipment to be able to keep these dogs stable when they're under anesthesia. I hope looking at those statistics, I haven't scared you away, but I think that, you know, if that needs to get done, start with a clean mouth, and hopefully with home care, you won't have to go through this again when she gets to be even older and at more risk.
Yeah.
Well, if you can advise me how to brush a very tiny mouth, I would appreciate that too.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't want to be brushing while the mouth is diseased, because that's going to create a dog that's going to be more afraid to have that brush come into their mouth because it's painful. This would be something that you would do after the fact. And there are some things that can be applied. There's one called Oravet, which is a kind of a tooth coating that you put on, like almost like a waxy coating that helps prevent tartar buildup. And again, that would be done after the mouth is clean. It's easy to apply. There are rinses, there are diets, there's other things that can be done besides brushing, although brushing is by far the best. And it may just mean coming up with the right size toothbrush for your dog to use.
Here we go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. As long as we're on the topic of anesthesia, Coco, our kitty, is probably getting close to a little anesthesia.
Yeah.
For some surgery today at
right.
the clinic.
Yeah. And the Coco's history is that he has had over the last 4 to 6 weeks some episodes of lower urinary tract disease where he would come in, bladder was small, he was straining, and, you know, we tried to manage him medically. He ended up obstructing once, required having catheter put in to allow him to urinate, and now this has happened again. And he is now going back in to have surgery done because the odds of him reobstructing are pretty high. Once you've had, you know, this happen more than once, you start getting scar tissue. Surgery that's being done is called a perineal urethrostomy. They're going to remove the narrow part of his urethra and give him a wider part to urinate through. It won't prevent him from developing the probably underlying condition that precipitated this, such as the blood and the straining and the
sure.
irritation. So he still is going to be needing medical management afterwards to be able to keep his bladder healthy just for his own comfort level. But hopefully this will prevent the medical emergency that you came home to on Sunday.
Yeah.
And you were right on bringing him in. His bladder was full. He was in distress and needed emergency care.
So hopefully that'll all be, well, I'm sure those are pretty successful surgery. And the anesthesia for a kitty is
very similar to it is for a dog, too.
Yeah.
And that's why they've had him in the hospital since Sunday, making sure that his kidney values are normal, that he's stable, to make having the surgery done a more successful proposition for him. Yep.
I wanted to go back to ticks for just a minute, flea and ticks, because I can't recall that we talked about a very young animal, and Amy emailed us, and she got an 11-week-old puppy, or she's getting one in May.
Mm-hmm.
What's the appropriate flea and tick cure for a young puppy?
Yeah, most of the products are going to have the age on it, on
okay.
the package. And so what, you know, typically because they're growing, using something like a collar that is going to last a long time and they may outgrow just doesn't seem appropriate. So probably the spot-on products are going to be the things to be using. And we just have to adjust the dose as they get a little bit older. And so weighing them on a monthly basis to make sure that you've got the right medication in. And typically things like Advantix, Frontline, any of those are going to be safe and labeled for puppies over 8 weeks of age.
Okay. We have lots of callers online. Our guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Vet Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks so much for joining in. Really appreciate your calls and questions. And Gloria Inshano has one for you, Sandy, so let's go to her. Gloria, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Thank you. Dr. Sawchuk, I've got a problem. We live out in the country, and we have two dogs, and one of them is half golden retriever and half Aussie, so he's got longer fur. And he was just diagnosed with anaplasmosis for the third time. And we used Frontline on him, and the Frontline quit working. The ticks were just all over him despite the Frontline. I tried Vectra,
mm-hmm.
and that didn't work. And so we've been picking ticks off for like 3 years.
Uh-huh.
But he just was diagnosed. I mean, he just finished another course of doxycycline. And I see that there is a new product out for fleas and ticks. I didn't catch when you first started talking. Is it the one there where it's approved for the dog tick but not for the deer tick?
That's right. And that would not be an appropriate product for in a heavy tick area where you're living. It's called NexGard for my dogs. Perfect. For your dog, you'd probably want to be staying with the topical things. Now, this is a few little misconceptions that have come up here. One, once a dog has been tested positive for anaplasmosis, which is a tick-borne disease that's spread by the deer tick, that can be they can be totally asymptomatic. Many dogs don't show any symptoms, and they just remain positive for years often. Sometimes they will have low platelet counts. They may have lameness, fever, and so on. And so typically when I get an anaplasma-positive dog back, I'll run a blood cell count to make sure that it's not affecting the bone marrow. But we rarely treat it if they're not showing any symptoms. And just know that every time you test your dog, they're probably going to be positive. That treatment is not going to eliminate that positive state. So I really think your dog's probably just persistently positive and not maybe not getting reinfected. But the big issue with ticks is that they are tough to kill. And they, you know, you're living in a very heavy tick area. And as a result, even if you're putting things like Frontline or Vectra or Advantix or any of those products on your dog, you're still going to find ticks. And you probably are going to be finding a lot more if you don't use anything than if you, you know, if than using something. So I would still be recommending using a spot-on product and yet still do daily tick checks once they come inside. It's just that's how important it is. It's really hard when you live in a tick area to know anything that is going to be, you know, super effective. There really isn't much out there that repels ticks except maybe some of the permethrin-based products, and that would be the new Frontline Tri-Tac. You may find that Advantix might be helpful, but this would be a case, too, where I might ask your veterinarian about trying the Seresto collar. I've had many people say that that has been the best thing that they've had for their dog because it tends to, one, it seems to be very effective, and they're finding fewer ticks when the dog comes in from being outside. So, again, don't give up on flea and tick control, and don't just depend on yourself because you're going to miss ticks. You know, still work on getting something else into your dog, whether it be one of these newer souped-up products like the Frontline Tri-Tac or the Seresto collar.
There you go.
What did you say it was?
The Seresto, yes, S-E-R-E-S-T-O.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, when he's had it, he gets it, he's acute. He lays on the floor, and it's almost like he's dead. And
So he is showing some symptoms of it. Yeah, okay. Yeah, but just know that he's probably going to be testing positive. And he can, just because he's been exposed in the past, is not going to prevent reinfection.
There you go. Thanks, Gloria, for calling. And Ray and Rhinelander, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Sandy, thank you for being on. You're very knowledgeable, and you have a very good way of conveying information.
Well, thank you.
And we've got spring coming up here in Rhinelander. Whoopee!
All right.
Anyways, I'm glad you were talking about the ticks, and you touched on the food with dogs. And my dog lost his eye with blastomycosis, and you're right, Sandy. He acts like he didn't even lose it. It's amazing.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yep.
Okay, my my question is maybe you can do a color code analysis on it. This is another vomit question, okay?
Mm-hmm.
My dog has been vomiting occasionally, off and on, you know, when he's out in the wild. I don't know if he gets something to eat. You know how they are.
Uh-huh.
And then it comes out kind of a yellowish color.
Okay.
Is that an alarming? Is that the natural color of processing? Maybe you should do a color chart.
Yeah. No. What you're seeing is probably bile. When bile originates down in the small intestine, it's produced by the liver, and it's part of the digestive process, especially for fats. And sometimes we'll get some bile refluxing up into the stomach, and it's irritating. And so we'll see dogs vomit up this kind of yellowy, foamy material. And, you know, we sometimes dogs will do this if they've gone without food for a while, if they've laid in a certain position for a bit and they've had some reflux. Most people complain about this as first thing in the morning before breakfast. The dog wakes up, they hear the stomach rumbling. up comes some bile, and then the dog feels good and is eating breakfast, and the rest of the day they have no trouble at all. And we give that a name called bilious vomiting syndrome. But there are other things that you want to be looking into to make sure that there isn't anything else going on, like some other underlying liver disease or another type of motility disorder. And so, again, talking to your veterinarian about this, and it is helpful to know exactly what the dog is vomiting up. So, and the fact that you're paying attention to the color is going to help narrow down the diagnostic process a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. But one thing that I found is that the dogs are feeling good. They're not having any troubles. It's typically when they have gone for a lengthy period of time without food, such as overnight. Feeding them a little bit before bed seems to give them some food on their tummy, and they do better. And I've had some dogs do better with just even getting a little Pepcid that you can buy over the counter, and you'd have to check with your veterinarian regarding the appropriate dose for your dog. But that's helped some of these dogs as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank
you very much. That was very helpful, and you have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for calling. Lynn in Hubertus, hi.
Hi. I have a relatively small beagle mix, and she's about 6.5 years old, and she inhales her food no matter what I do or how I give it to her. She just inhales. My only concern is ingesting all that air and the potential stomach twisting, which I had a dog die from. So I'm really concerned about.
Yeah. Yeah. When I have dogs that do this, like the first thing I usually recommend is changing the way you're feeding your dog. And there's a number of things that you can do depending on how fast the dog likes to eat. Sometimes feeding them on like a big cookie sheet where it's spread out, where they have to take it kibble by kibble by kibble, slows them down. There are, if you go online and just, you know, do a search for interactive pet food bowls, there's a couple of new ones out for dogs that one looks like a giant blades of grass. It's about 18 inches around, and it's got these plastic, heavy-duty plastic spikes of green plastic. And so when you put the food in, the dog has to work around all these little obstructions to be able to get the food. There's some that look like a maze where you put the food in and they have to kind of push it with their paw and their nose to be able to get it to come out. And these are all methods of trying to slow the dog down. Sometimes even just feeding them in a treat ball. There's different treat containers that you can adjust the opening size to actually hold kibble is another way of giving her some exercise and slowing her down as well. And, you know, a beagle mix, are they prone to bloating? Any dog potentially can bloat, but it's usually the deep-chested, you know, real narrow-chested dogs like the setters and those types of dogs that seem to run into more troubles with that.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thanks, Lynn. Thank you for calling. And Kathy in Wausau. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello.
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 Thank you for taking my call, and your program is one of the best programs on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
But all the time. And I'm calling about my 5-year-old male cat who was recently hospitalized, and we were about to put him down because he had crystals in his bladder, and they were lodged in his penis.
Mm-hmm.
His labs were off reach, and then with subcutaneous fluids and so on, he started coming around, and he made a comeback, and everything is normal, and he's on a special urinary cat food. And my question is, I'm wondering if there is an over-the-counter cat food for urinary problems that I could get for him rather than always buying the...
Yeah, and I'm going to say that it really depends. It's going to depend on what type of crystalluria your cat had. The over-the-counter diets are simply diets that are a little more acidifying. And so when you go and see like a urinary tract health formula or something like that, that's an over-the-counter diet, those only may help with controlling a type of crystal called struvite stones or struvite crystals. Because we see a number of cats that have another type called oxalate, by just feeding an over-the-counter diet, you potentially could make your cat worse because both of those types of crystals and stones like to form in different environments. One likes to form in an acid environment. One likes to form in a more basic environment. And so the therapeutic diets that are out there have the right levels of minerals in the diet. They keep a moderate pH, so it's not going to go either way to support the development of crystals. And so, unfortunately, you know, you're really almost, you're stuck with using a therapeutic diet that would be appropriate for your cat. But check with your veterinarian. If it was struvite crystals, if it, you know, if that was the issue, then potentially these over-the-counter diets may be helpful.
Is that the more common one, the struvite?
They're about equal now. When the problem we saw was that we hardly ever saw 20 years ago oxalate stones, and it's because it's, you know, we just, the way diets and everything were, but we saw lots of cats with struvite, and so they came out with all these acidifying diets to prevent cats from getting struvite stones, and guess what? We started unmasking all these cats that are oxalate formers because they like to form in an acidic environment. And so we started seeing, in fact, in the last 20 years, it's been a 20 times increase in the number of cases that we've seen of oxalate crystals in cats. So they are becoming very prevalent.
Thanks, Kathy, for calling. Appreciate it. Pat in East Troy, hello. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. About a month ago, I let my golden retriever out to run in the deep, deep snow, and she located a place where a rabbit had evacuated and ate it. It looked just like kibbles to her.
Cocoa Puffs. Yeah. Yeah, there's really no problem with that except just the gross out factor that it's, you know, she may come in with bad breath and may have fecal material on her teeth. Always before lunch, we always get this question.
Yeah.
The only other thing is the stool sample may come back positive for a rabbit parasite called Imeria, which is a coccidia that doesn't affect dogs. It's just going in one end and out the other. And so you may see that, and you may see a yeast called Cyniclomyces. And sometimes that can be confusing when we get that back on a stool sample. But, you know, if we've got the history of your dog eating rabbit droppings, then we just blow that off and say it's nothing. So don't worry about it.
There you go.
What good news. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We are taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. We've gone in and talked a little about flea and tick management. We've talked about overweight. And, of course, we've taken many questions from folks just like you. So, and we're going to continue to do that. She'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. If you'd like to join in, you can call at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Don't forget to post a photo. We'll be back right after the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Pleased to have with me as a guest today Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, talking about your pet's health today, and I hope you'll join in. Our lines are all filled right now. Here's the number, though. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can also go to my Facebook page and post there. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can post a question or comment there. And Dr. Sandy, thanks for being with us again.
It's nice to be here.
And we have a Facebook question from Libby wondering if you could go over your recommendations for ordering prescriptions online. We're giving my 3-year-old German Shepherd Panacare Plus powder. I'd really like to do some price shopping since we're going to need to continue him on these meds.
Well, this is going to be a question that is going to come up more and more for veterinarians potentially. There's an act that's trying to get passed through Congress called the Affordable Pet Care Act, which is going to potentially require veterinarians to write a outside prescription for anything and allow the owner to decide where they want to get their medication. And so, it may mean that, yes, you want to get it at your vet, but you still have or are given that option. And I'm not sure exactly whether it's going to pass. This is the second time they've tried to get this through. And so I do get this question a lot from people saying, you know, what about ordering online? Are you more expensive than the online pharmacies? And we've done some little, in fact, yesterday I sat down with some students and did some price checking on some of the online pharmacies. And boy, there's a huge difference out there. A product that we sell for about $52 was $87 at one online pharmacy and $128 at another one. And the one that was $128 is the one that advertises all the time that says we're cheaper than your veterinarian. So don't believe the ads all the time. It can be very, very different. The things to be looking for if you are going to be wanting to do an online pharmacy is there's a little symbol on the pharmacy's startup page that is a gold seal, kind of an oblong oval, and it says VET VIPS. It stands for Veterinary Verified Internet Pharmacy Practice. And it just means that they've got veterinarians on staff, that you know that you're going to be getting the drugs that you're ordering, that they're not going to be outdated, that they do follow all the letters of the law for requiring prescriptions and so on. And it's for many of the online pharmacies, it's really easy. You provide them with your veterinarian's name and their fax number, and they fax the prescription. We sign it, fax it back, and away you go. You've got your medication. I just recently did this with my own dog. I ordered some medication through an online pharmacy, and I had to write my own prescription. I put my name down as the veterinarian, provide my fax number. I get into work. There's the fax. I had to sign it, send it back, and then I get an email. Yay, your veterinarian's approved this, even though it was me writing the prescription. So, I think that's the big thing, is looking, price shopping. May or may not, you know, you may be able to find it cheaper, but and also talk to your veterinarian. There are many veterinarians that will do, you know, like price matching if you can provide them with a site where it might be less expensive.
Yep, there we go. Holly and Nina, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I have a 14-month-old silver lab, a female. And she has not come into her first heat. When we got her, she has kind of an inverted vulva slightly, and she had an infection early on. She has not had that since. And the vet recommended we wait until her first heat to see if that, you know, takes care of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I am wondering, when I do spay her finally, hopefully she'll come into heat pretty soon here, what is the alternative these days? And if you could give me some general pros and cons about ovarectomies and the full hysterectomy, and even I've been hearing about tubal ligations a little bit.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
What would your recommendations be?
Well, the tubal ligation would prevent pregnancy, but it is not going to eliminate all the different things that can happen with ovaries being present, such as breast cancer, uterine infections, that type of thing. So, you know, I would not be recommending that. If you're, you know, doing it, I mean, sometimes they'll do that for if you need what's called a teaser bitch, where you can have a dog in heat but is not able to get pregnant. You know, that might be the reason to do that, but I really don't see the benefit in having that done. So it really comes down to, do you do a full ovariohysterectomy, which is taking out the uterus as well as the ovaries, or just the ovaries? And classically, as a veterinarian, and this is the way I was trained, is you do everything. You take out the ovaries and the uterus. But when you really start looking at the big culprit are the ovaries. Though, if once the ovaries are gone, the uterine disease risk is very, very minimal. Uterine cancer is rare. It's benign in up to about 90% of the cases, and the risk is about 0.003%. So, you know, very, very low risk of having a malignant tumor in the uterus. Uterine infections, when the ovaries are gone, are non-existent, because you need that ovarian hormonal flux to be able to cause things like pyometras. So, you know, it comes down to what your veterinarian is comfortable with. An ovariectomy allows the veterinarian to make a smaller incision that's a little more cranial. And if they are adept at using laparoscopic equipment, an ovariectomy can be done laparoscopically, which allows for smaller incisions, kind of a faster back to normal activity time, versus a spay, where you're doing the full, taking the ovaries and uterus out, you're going to have a bigger incision. It's going to take a little bit longer to heal, Complication-wise, they're both very safe procedures. The only complication that we tend to see with ovariohysterectomy versus ovariectomy is that you can potentially, because of the longer incision, have some complications that way, but you may also have a higher chance of what's called ovarian remnant syndrome. Just because of the way the incision is made, there's a potential that a little bit of ovary may get left behind because you're trying to remove everything from an incision that's a little bit back more caudal. So I think it's really a flip of a coin, and I tend to look at what the veterinarian is most skilled at, and that would be, you know, for many vets doing the full ovariohysterectomy. But if you've got a veterinarian that can do laparoscopic work, by all means, get an ovariectomy done.
There you go. Thank you, Holly, for calling. Susan in Summit, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a problem. I've got, if you can believe it, a 15-year-old Welsh Corgi who's been diabetic for 8 years.
Wow.
And is well managed, but we're obviously getting towards, well, I guess my question is, I want to know, because you were talking about, you know, doing different tests and things like that. His teeth are terrible. He's going blind. He's almost deaf, but he's still getting up every morning. And if we get him some ground beef, he eats his food, and I can get him to, we live in the country, and I can get him to walk down to the barn and back, and that's about all, twice a day. But he seems happy, but I just want to know, you know, he's beginning to get very weak in the back end, and, you know, as I say, his teeth look like they're about ready to fall out, I think. And I know we're towards the end, but I want some advice about, do we do anything at this point? Do we do any tests? Do we just watch him? And
yeah.
And when's it time? Because, you know, right now I can say he's a happy dog.
Yeah. And, you know, looking at quality of life involves so many aspects, from not only kind of mental happiness. Does he still perk up when he sees you? Is he still wanting to be social? Is he able to void outside versus having accidents in the house and being upset? Is he still mobile enough that he can get up on his own or with maybe some assistance? You know, appetite is one thing to consider. There's all of these things. And we call it the quality of life scale. And it's kind of based on the human hospice quality of life scale as well. And that would be something that I would be more than willing to send you a copy of if you want to email me. That is something that I provide to my clients. And so they can kind of go through and it on a week-by-week basis. You can kind of look at, are we slipping in any of these areas? Because each category you assign a number, and when we start getting the numbers being skewed on the lower side, it may be time to start thinking about, you know, is his life really worth living at this point? The concern I have about the dental disease is it can be a complicating factor for trying to maintain his diabetes. We know that oral infections are probably one of the leading causes of dogs losing control of their diabetes, and can affect their appetite and so on. And remember, age isn't a disease, and he may be, although an at-risk anesthetic candidate, he may be able to be managed very successfully, and it may provide him with some better quality of life after a procedure like that. If you feel that the fact that he only wants to eat ground beef or anything like that, that may be part of his dental disease showing you that he's having some issues with it. But it is a tough situation because it's not just based on the dog, but it's also based on you. And you may be in a situation where you're able to bathe him, manage him, help him up. If I had a dog like this and I'm not home for 12 hours a day, what would I do? I mean, I would have to hire pet sitters. It would be so disruptive that sometimes the decision is made based on the humans and the quality of life that the human is experiencing with the pet as well. And everybody's an individual. And I wish I could say now's the time or now isn't. But even if I knew your dog and I knew you, it's still a decision that unfortunately you have to make. We can be there to guide you, but that's it.
Yeah. So,
I just email you and I can get this quality of life
scale. Yes, that would be fine.
You know, would you post that on my Facebook page?
Sure. I'd be glad to do that. Yeah.
That'd be wonderful. And then, you know, so it'd be available for others too.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
We have lots of great questions coming up here. We had Sarah emailed us one about her two cats were just treated for tapeworms, wondering if these can be treated or transferred to humans. The vet told me that my dog would be okay, but I forgot to ask about the humans.
Ah, really good question. Tapeworms are a really interesting parasite in that there is no direct transmission from cat to cat, cat to dog, cat to person. You know, they all have to go through what's called an intermediate host. And there's two types of fleas that we see cats and dogs picking up primarily. One is called the cat or types of tapeworm. One is called the flea tapeworm, and they get it from ingesting fleas that have the cyst stage of the tapeworm in it. The other one is, which is probably how your cats got it, is the one from eating rabbits and rodents. And those are, you know, again, if your dog were to eat some of those segments, it wouldn't matter. But if your dog were to share the meal of the rabbit, then that could potentially be a problem. So nothing to worry about on your part. But this is just a, you know, a good example. There's for dogs now, a new heartworm preventative out that is called Sentinel Spectrum. And if for dogs, especially dogs that are scavengers, this particular heartworm preventative not only controls heartworm, roundworms, hookworms, and whipworms, but also has a tapeworm preparation in it as well. And the other one that is out there that's like this is called Iverheart Max. The Sentinel Spectrum is in a beefy cube, so it's a little more palatable, at least from my experience. Not that I've taken it, but watching other pets take it, yes.
You know, all this talk about organisms, I'm thinking about tomorrow's show, because tomorrow I have Professor Rob Dunn on. He's the author of Wildlife of Our Bodies.
Ooh.
And among other things, he studied belly buttons. And they've collected samples from I don't know how many hundred. And the average person has something like 67 different organisms in their belly button.
My goodness, yeah. And, you know, one of the things that we do with students, too, is when we're studying mites and things, is we start having students kind of pluck their eyelashes and so on out and look. And it's amazing how many of us have mites living in our you know, hair follicles and so on that we don't even know are there. It's just kind of part of our life.
Well,
yeah.
We're going to be dealing with that tomorrow.
All right.
John in Chippewa Falls. Hi to you. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I'll have to listen to that program tomorrow. That's really interesting. Anyway, I have a four-month-old golden doodle, and she ate a couple cedar waxwings that were dead in the yard about 2 weeks ago. And since then, she's gone through some bouts of diarrhea, and we put her on a rice chicken diet, and seems to clear it up, and then we introduce her food back to her, and then she gets diarrhea almost immediately. And the vet said, so we've taken her in twice, and the vet said yesterday that we should probably do it for another 3 or 4 days because she thinks that it might be stress and not something related. You know, I was concerned that maybe she has salmonella or something on this order.
Well, as you said the word salmonella, I keep a little piece of paper in front of me because, you know, at this point in my life, sometimes I forget to bring things up, and I was just writing salmonella ? down. Yeah, that is something that we get concerned about if this is going, you know, on and on and on. Usually a typical puppy with a dietary indiscretion, you know, a day or two of a bland diet, and then they're back to normal again. But things that I would be looking at, besides maybe talking to your veterinarian about culturing the stool for salmonella, would be because they ate some birds, you know, is there foreign material in there, bones, anything that could be a problem? And I don't know if your veterinarian's done any just survey radiographs to see if we have like a stomach full of foreign material or something lodged in the intestinal tract. And so that would be something to consider as well. But I also think that it's a good idea not only to check a stool sample for parasites, but also to get a Giardia antigen test done as well. Sometimes puppies that Giardia is one of those very common puppy parasites. They estimate that about 30% of puppies have Giardia. And all it takes is something to change the gut flora a little bit, like eating a couple of cedar wax wings, and that can cause the Giardia to become more clinical. And so, you know, it's stress with vaccinating, stress with diet change, stress from going from a kennel to a new home. Those are all things that can result in the puppy sometimes having clinical giardiasis. So getting a Giardia test done as well would be helpful. But because those tests can sometimes be negative, even if the dog has the disease, we often just go through a therapeutic deworming. And the drug that we would use would be something called Panacure Fenbendazole. And we use it usually for about 5 days. I'm going to give you a website so you can kind of arm yourself with information on this. It's the Companion Animal Parasite Council. It's called CAPC. But if you go to CAPCVET.org, okay, so it's CAPCVET.org. Wonderful site, and it has links to client education sites, but the veterinary area is very easy to traverse yourself. You can just go on the G, click on it, and it'll bring up Giardia, and you can do a little more reading about that. But I think your dog deserves to have a little more workup done rather than just looking at a diet change.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And Tony in Wisconsin Dells, hi to you.
Hello. I have a question. I have a dog that's about 6 years old, Vizsla, Beagle, Retriever, Mutt type mix, just like me.
Uh-huh.
And it has a habit. It's a little more of a nervous dog, a little more shy of a dog. It's not a biter, but it's a dog that isn't as aggressive as a lot of others. It's about 30 pounds. It gets into the syndrome where it wants to do this kind of compulsive swallowing.
Mm-hmm.
And what'll happen is if I can set her on my lap for a while and pet her, it seems to go away. But if I let her just run, she'll go out and eat grass or pick up lint around the house and vomit. But that doesn't even seem to stop it. And I've looked in her throat, and it's not like she ate something that was, you know, wood chips or animal bones or anything like that. But it's like a nervous thing, I'm thinking. What thoughts do you have on that?
I'm more concerned that there may be something physiologic going on. When we see dogs kind of doing that swallowing, I get worried that they're nauseated for some reason, that they feel like, you know, my tummy's upset. And the fact that if you let her go out, she's going to start trying to consume things, which are often purgatives to make the dog try to vomit. That kind of goes hand in hand. I wouldn't expect that if it was just behavioral, that you would see her going out and eating non-food items, once she's doing this. So I'd be thinking more, do you have a dog that has, and it may be that it is that your dog is refluxing, your dog has, you know, some stomach irritation, and the behavior issues may just bring it on. But I'd be going down the medical path before I would start looking at this from a behavior standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and would you suggest, for example, I've always given her the same food. She seems to do really well. Candida, she's doing really well on
it.
And I don't give her a lot of table scraps. I mean, I let her lick out pans and things like that.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, and if, you know, keeping a diary as to what she's had, because if it's something that's greasy that stimulates this, that could be a problem. You may want to consider going on like an intestinal friendly diet for a bit, at just something that's a low fat, highly digestible diet. You can talk to your veterinarian about what one they would recommend, and just see if maybe, you know, changing the diet that way would have some benefit for her. Again, I've mentioned using things like Pepcid AC, over-the-counter products like that that help settle the stomach. Some dogs do well with that. But I think getting this looked into to make sure that there isn't any other underlying problem going on would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling. Someone wondered about Dinovit supplement for dogs. Have you heard of
it? I have not heard about it. But, you know, I'm always concerned about supplements. If the dog is on a balanced diet, do we need to be giving any other supplements? And there are some supplements like joint supplements and things that may be very helpful, but a vitamin supplement typically is not going to be a balanced vitamin. It's not going to supplement a dog if you're doing like a homemade unbalanced diet. And, you know, the commercial diets that you have available to you, so many of them out there, very well balanced, and you may just be pushing the dog over the edge when it comes to giving them extra things they don't need.
Well, wow. Yeah. Here we went through
lots of different things today.
Lots of different things today. Sandy, thank you so much. I don't know if we ever did get through. We didn't get through all the tick questions you had.
I have a whole bunch of flea and tick questions, but because flea season is really going to get started next month, we'll just save that for next month.
All right. Thank you. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Vet Medicine, our guest today. She's usually on the second Tuesday of the month, so in May she'll be on Tuesday, May 13th. Which is the second Tuesday of the month. So I certainly look forward to that. And again, I mentioned a few minutes earlier that we have the author of a book called The Wildlife of Our Bodies on tomorrow, Rob Dunn. If you want to find out how many bacteria and whatever you got in your belly button, you better tune in. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.